You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Heritage Radio Network On Tour. Today we're bringing you inside the Slow Seed Summit, a conference hosted by Slow Food USA, presenting perspectives on food security, seed preservation and sovereignty, and community engagement. The conference took place between May 13th and 15th, 2022, and as media partners for the summit, we're excited to give you an inside look at key conversations. Enjoy this peek into the Slow Seed Summit.
My name is Shelley Buffalo. First off, let me introduce myself. And I am from the Meskwaki tribe. Our community is located in central Iowa. We are a Great Lakes Eastern Woodlands tribe. So we have migrated over the course of a couple hundred years from the St. Lawrence River Valley, kind of in the what is currently upstate New York. So I'm very grateful to have been asked to moderate this session and to welcome seed rematriators that are present here. So this session is seed rematriation, bringing seeds home. This work is, I don't know, with seed rematriation, it's good to kind of remove your ideas about seed keeping as seeds as objects, because for indigenous women, these seeds are our relatives. These seeds are our ancestors, and that is the relationship that we have with them. We just have 30 minutes for everybody in, for our panel guests to talk about the work that we're doing. So we're going to just launch right into that. And I will have the guests introduce themselves, especially since today I seem to be having problems talking. And so I want to say welcome. Thank you for being here and for sharing your time and energy and knowledge in this space. We will start with Dr. Rebecca Webster.
All right. Sigoli Swagwek, Ganyate Gelu Nyungyet Sungwehuene, Becky Webster Nyungyet Slunige, Wagwaho Niwigit Talod, Oneote Aga, Niwagarahuman Jot, Dulunko Wane, Niwagenu. So, what I just said in English is greetings, everybody. My name is Ganyate Gale, which means snow scattered here and there. My English name is Becky Webster. I'm Wolf Clan, I'm Oneida, and I grew up near Duck Creek that runs through the Oneida Reservation. So what I'm going to be sharing with you today is our adventures on our farmstead with our seeds and caring for our food relatives, all the way from planting to harvesting, to cooking and sharing them with our community. So we bought this property that we're on in 2017. And what I'm going to be talking about today is really that whole adventure. When we talked to our faith keeper about what we had planned for this property, he came up with this name, Toslu. It means our foods, where we plant things. And as you'll see through the presentation, it's about more than just planting those seed relatives. It's about planting ideas, philosophies, and just generally a way of life. Next slide, please. So we have a pretty tumultuous history, as all Indigenous people do. We've had, you know, colonization, removal, assimilation, all of that has really impacted our relationship, not only with our seeds, our language, our culture, even our own history sometimes has been disrupted. And sometimes we have to lay some of those practices down until there's a time where it's safe to pick it back up again. But even through all of that, we've had an unbroken relationship with our corn, bean, and squash all the way back to creation. And it has maintained a part of our daily and our ceremonial lives. When it wasn't safe for a lot of us to practice that out in the open, there were enough families that went underground with this to be able to keep it safe for when a time came where the rest of us can practice that out in the open. And today is that time. So we're now finally able to be able to do these things, celebrate our seeds, practice our ceremonies without being afraid of being persecuted for that. So that has really happened within our lifetimes, that we've seen these things go from something that you only whisper about and talk about quietly to things that we're doing out in the open, out loud, and just being really excited about it. Next slide, please. So we're relatively new to this. In 2015 was the first time that we planted our indigenous heirloom seeds, and that was our Tuscarora white corn. And on the left, you see 2015, we had this scraggly little Charlie Brown braid of corn, but we were so excited to grow this corn. We were just so proud of this funky looking braid. And we were hooked ever since then. So we had planted a number of gardens after that and then decided to go all in. And this last picture is most of our harvest from this past year, with an emphasis on Haudenosaunee varieties of corn, beans, squash, tobacco, and sunflowers. So we've come quite a ways in this short amount of time. And every year we learn so much about those seed relatives coming home to us. And it's a little bit terrifying because we just know we're only scratching the surface. Like, how much knowledge is still out there for us to try to gather and share with our children so that they don't have to try so hard to gather that information. That's really the key of why we do what we do. Next slide. So here's our property. We had purchased this in 2017, a 10-acre chunk of land that had been, you know, not treated very well. This last half, the lighter portion with those dark squiggly lines on it and the dots everywhere, those are actually tires. Over 2,000 tires were on this property, along with over 10 plastic barrels and rotten wooden structures all over the place. This was a former paintball field, and I'm sure it was a blast to be out there. I never went out there to play paintball. So our first encounter with this field was when we were purchasing it. We had the seller remove these, the tires, of course, but we had to remove the other things like the barrels and the wooden structures. That front acreage along the road there was conventionally cropped, and it had very poor soil with heavy clay, and there was a drainage area in the front. So we knew we had a whole lot of work to do on this land to be able to prepare this land to be able to care for our seed relatives. Next slide. So we were able to get the help of some USDA grants. So we have a 1-acre pollinator habitat out along the road, along with a border around the property, so to speak, that was that we're dedicating to tree planting. We're trying to plant indigenous tree species to our area. We also have a 30 by 90 high tunnel that has been really exciting growing in, because it's supposed to extend the season a month earlier and a month later, so we can get our food started in there earlier. And they live in there, they stay in there. It's not like a greenhouse where you take them out, you plant right into the ground. So we're able to get different corn crops too, because they will tassel and silk at different times. We don't have to worry about cross-pollination. So we can grow out varieties in the high tunnel, and then the next year, grow them out in the garden area. Next slide. So I mentioned that drainage area. We ended up turning it into a pond for more habitat restoration for this area. So we dug it in 2018 when we built our home, and then we expanded it in 2020 to be able to create a field access to that pollinator habitat area, which soon is going to be hosting some beehives. So we're pretty excited to have them move on to our property. It was really sad when we had to drain the pond to expand it, because there were a lot of toads and frogs that had called that place home. And when we drained it, they left, because you couldn't hear them singing at night anymore. It was so sad. But then when we filled the pond filled back up naturally, because we have such heavy clay, and then we waited and we waited and we waited. And about a month or so later, the toads and the frogs came back and they were singing again. So we're really reassured that we're doing the right thing in this area to be able to provide that habitat. We want to eventually get to a wind-powered aerator for that, because it's really doesn't flow out too much. It's more really of a drainage trap for the rest of our property. Next slide. So our focus is on Three Sisters Mounds. That's the main gardening that we do here on our property. And I think we have about over 200 of these mounds. And we plant the Three Sisters together, the corn, the beans, and the squash. And they have these amazing roles that they play they work together. The corn grows tall and strong. The beans crawl up that corn stalk, providing nitrogen to the soil. The squash covers the ground and spreads out, helping keep the moisture in the soil, keeping the weeds out, and even keeping the animals out. And we have one of our farm dogs, Stella, over there in the picture. We post pictures of our gardens and we have Stella for scale. So that was July of 1 year, and the corn in the mounds was doing amazing. So we use Stella there to show how those mounds were doing. Next slide. So here's just a real overview of our property. Our goals, what we do, we grow corn, beans, squash, sunflower, sunchokes, and tobacco. And last summer, we were so excited to finally gain 501c3 tax-exempt nonprofit status so that we will be able to hunt for grants to help us continue to educate our community about all of the different things about seed keeping, about planting, about harvesting, preservation, cooking. We hold lots of different classes here for the community to be able to come and gather to serve as another source where they learn about these things and they have access to our traditional heirloom varieties. So next slide. So this just talks about some of those events. So we recently built a farmstead kitchen where we host classes in there about how we, you know, process our corn. We hold outdoor cooking events. We pound black ash to make baskets that help further in our cooking, like for corn washing. We had one of our local Oneida potters come out and do a pottery demonstration, and everyone was able to make a pot. So these are some of the things that we're doing to be able to celebrate those seed relatives through that whole entire process. Next slide. And this is that farmstead kitchen that we were able to build using some grant money that we recently obtained by getting that 501c3 status. So we're pretty excited to be able to welcome the community in here to be able to learn. And we have a number of events coming up over the summer. And we even have a retreat of our, a couple of tribal departments are coming to spend the day with us to learn about processing our foods and getting to know those foods better. So next slide, and hopefully this one works. It's a aerial of the property, a drone footage. So that's the corn in the high tunnel from last year. And we had some tomatoes and some beans growing in there as well. And then we're coming out looking at the back of the house. There's some mounds on the right. You'll be able to see those right at the end of the slide too. And then, so this is the pollinator habitat and tree planting. And there's the pond, and you can see our Three Sisters garden. We have a lot of beans that are planted on trellises so that we can grow more varieties of our beans. And we have a number of bush beans that are out there as well. A lot of berries that we grow here too. And there was a vacant spot over there. It was a little bit glitchy on my end. I don't know what it looked like for you guys, but that's where the farmstead kitchen ended up being. So last summer, it was just a slab that we had poured, and now it's that farmstead kitchen. So our philosophy here on our farmstead is that every time an Indigenous person plants a seed, that is an act of resistance, an assertion of sovereignty, and a reclamation of identity. Yeah, Uncle.
Thank you, Becky. As usual, an amazing presentation. Thank you for that. So we're going to quickly move on to Kirsten. Kirsten Kirby-Schut, please tell us about yourself and the work that you do.
Hi. As she mentioned, my name is Kirsten Kirby-Schut. I'm Shinkit from Raven Moiti, although I was raised away from the village. My village in Alaska, I was actually brought up in Portland, Oregon, so an urban environment. And thank you so much, Becky, for that presentation. I love the drone footage. It'd be cool to get a number of Indigenous farms involved in that aspect, so we can kind of check out visually how everybody's farm is doing. It was really encouraging. I am in Detroit, Michigan, and I run a small, about under an acre project called Shesu Gardens. And Shesu means butterfly in Tlingit. It's really about the transformative nature of our seeds and our relationship to the land. Right now is my first year in this new space. And if you want to follow along, I'm at _hologram. And I think it's in the chat section. But as I mentioned, I'm in Detroit, so a lot of the soil has been harmed, and there's a lot of trauma here due to colonization, due to the policing of Black and brown bodies, and that's still very heavy in the air here. So when I moved to Detroit, I immediately reached out to a few contacts I had gathered actually from Slow Food. I read a Slow Food article from or about Shiloh Maples, who actually connected me to Rosebud, who's the next presenter. And at the time they were working for American Indian Health and Family Services and had this amazing garden named Sacred Roots and programming surrounding that. And so that's actually, I'd like to thank my mentors for that, because it spurred me to learn more about my cultural plants and foster my relationship with them. For me, seeds act as a telephone between generations. And although settler colonialism has destroyed a lot, it hasn't destroyed those connections that we have with our seeds. And they connect me to knowledge that I couldn't possibly know myself. And I think that's why a lot of seed keepers end up kind of naming seeds as their teachers, is because they teach them something new. If it was already in our minds, then there would be no new knowledge. And I think that's something that Shesu Gardens is really focused on, is bringing in people and having them start relationships with their seed relatives. The urban aspect of it is something I find interesting, and I see like people tuning in from all over, and a lot of people are in more urban environments, and I'd heavily encourage people to know that the land, whether it's urban, whether it's on the res, whether you're in a rural area or a suburb, that the land knows the people that are on it, and there is a responsibility to be in relationship with the land and properly have a proper relationship with it. And that, I guess more people think of it as like human on human relationships. But just as you wouldn't, throw garbage on your friend, you would not throw garbage on your land relative. And I think that's very important to foster empathy when we're talking about land-based projects. And honestly, every season is a conversation and a lesson, and it's comforting to know, for me personally, that seeds don't start and end with us. There's not a binary when it comes to our relationship with seeds. And I think that's a very special relationship that we need to acknowledge and take care of. I think Becky mentioned actually about like the freedom to actually grow and plant our seeds, and that knowledge was kept in secret. And we would be prosecuted for it. But I also would like the audience to understand that we are still being prosecuted for our ceremonies and our gathering of food. And I mean, maybe Rosebud wants to follow up with this. Because let me see, yeah. But we were recently gathering maple syrup, and we had a ceremony to kick off Sugarbush, and there's actually like police presence there. And so although we have come out and made strides within being validated by settler colonialism, we have to realize that we are still held in that grip, and that the fight for food sovereignty is still present, and that's why I grow, and yeah. You want to go, Rosebud?
Yeah, Rosebud, just go ahead and launch in there. Talk about the work you're doing and your experience. Just anything that you'd like to share with us, and give us a little bio. Thank you.
Sure. Anibujub, Masinoko Indigenous, Makododem, Wabiya Tanang and Donjiba, Anishinaabe and Dao. So my English name is Rosebud Bear Schneider. I am originally from Detroit. I'm Bear Clan. I'm in Anishinaabe. My people come from all over Turtle Island. My mother's family is Purepecha from Mexico and Apache. And my father's family is Ojibwe from Northern Wisconsin and also Shawnee from Oklahoma. So I represent Turtle Island in a really good way, well-rounded way. I'm currently talking to you all from Detroit. And I wanna say, thank you to Slow Food for asking me to be on this panel. It's a huge honor to be in the presence of Shelly and Becky and Kirsten and all of you. And so I just want to say miigwech for that. My work in food sovereignty has really, really started, before there was we've always been kind of doing this work before there was a word for it. I start having these little memories pop up from, being a kid and growing up with activist parents, not quite understanding what they're doing, but, we're doing something in the community. But really my work, my career did not get started on this path until I became a mom. My children are 12 and 14. When I had them, there wasn't a doubt that I would nurse them, breastfeed them and nourish them the way my body is meant to do. That we can't talk about food sovereignty without mentioning that first. That is our first food. And that really sparked again my journey, my fire, my passion for this work and overall community work. Kirsten said, I worked for American Indian Health and Family Services for about 10 years. First as a breastfeeding educator and a community health worker, doing home visits with families with young babies. That morphed into garden work, as when you work in the community, there's always other duties as assigned, and a lot of it, ended up getting centered around outside work and caring for the little garden that we had in the yard there. And then a grant opportunity came across, and it was a policy systems and environmental change grant. So one of the things that was listed that we could do was food sovereignty, food access. And with that, we started a community readiness survey and a community assessment, and then turned that into an actual strategic plan planning session with the community. And what we learned in those first steps was that folks really wanted a connection to their foods. They wanted more access. They wanted, and not just access eating, but access growing and learning about what, you know, what our ancestors did. So myself and Shiloh Maples, who is also a phenomenal woman doing this work, her and I set out to learn as much as we could to bring it, then bring it back to our community and share that knowledge. That's how my work with Slow Food started. There is a Detroit chapter here. And we quickly got involved with that. We were able to go to Italy two times before the pandemic. And that was a life-changing life-changing time. My path on specifically with seed rematriation really started with Sacred Roots. And, you know, learning alongside and learning from Becky Webster. You know, it's a lot of us have started this path together, and it's really beautiful. And I mean, I want to echo everything that my two sisters just said. It's why we do the work that we do. And I am Kirsten, for sure. Her and I have worked so closely together, and building these connections and building community around seed matriation and around food sovereignty and food access, specifically culturally appropriate foods. That's the whole point. That's what we want to do. We want this good stuff to keep spreading. And in, you know, another 5-10 years, there'll be other people that came after us still carrying on this work. And I think that's something else to remember is that, you know, for me, I do this work to think, you know, for the next 7 generations, we have to leave our ancestors, our coming in ancestors, a good world to live in. And that starts with all this knowledge, a lot of knowledge. And I would love for my great, great grandkids to not have to keep relearning things and not, you know, not have to reclaim and reconnect. And, you know, it's, as Kirsten mentioned, it is, you know, my whole life has been in a, you know, in an urban setting. And it is hard to have access to culture and to our food and to our people. But when you have communities like this in Detroit, it makes it easier. All of us are so hungry for this connection and for this, for each other, you know, for community, especially now coming out of a pandemic. I'm really looking forward to reconnecting. In the last 3 years, I spent up in northern Michigan working on a farm called Ziba Mijuang. We also had a store called Minogan Market. That is on Wakanuxing territory, so Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawas. They own that farm. They own that land that we worked on. It's a 300-acre farm. 100 of it is tillable. It was purchased back in 2014, and we are moving into a new chapter as this business. We're taking some time to restructure and to reassess some of our mission. We produce maple products, and we also have a strong focus on seed rematriation there, growing out our ancestral seeds. Some of the main things that I would like to focus focus on currently. I'm from Detroit, here in Detroit, but I am now a board member for Zebra Mutual. So I'm really excited to see what the future has in store for that farm. But yeah, as Kirsten mentioned, here in Detroit, it's definitely an interesting place to be Indigenous. But it's all I've ever known. You know, being a child of a AIM activist, there's always something going on. There's always like ways that we are connecting with community. My dad did a lot of work here in the city in different ways. He did a lot of repatriation work, and he did a lot of education around our culture. And I, you know, a lot of folks are like, oh, you're following your dad's footsteps. I'm like, yeah, I am. But I'm also like walking along his footsteps and making my own way. So I'm, you know, again, so appreciative of this life that I've built for my family and for my community. And I'm, completely grateful. And I'm a little taken, you know, listening to Kirsten talk, it just warms my heart so much. Like, I was over here like tearing up listening to her. So Miigwech, I'm going to stop talking now. Miigwech, again, for having me. Thanks.
All right, Rosebud, thank you so much for talking about. And I, you know, there's like, I know there's so much more to talk about, just like specifically about Detroit. The Meskwaki have a Detroit connection. In fact, you know, we were driven out of Detroit and historically. And one of our famous quotes that we still live by, which is, you know, as we're being driven out, is "Know ye that the fox, they are immortal." So I, you know, I have every intention of coming to Detroit and being in community with you and reestablishing the Meskwaki presence in Detroit, because, you know, it's in the form of a garden, right? Because that's like that loving, you know, reestablishing the relationship with the land through our seeds. I want to, like, one of the things that I wanted to, I guess, you know, if any of you can speak to this, I think, like, but this question is more specific for Becky. Is that so? You are Dr. Rebecca Webster, and I mean, in order to earn your law degree and your professorship, you know, everything that you've done, I mean, it takes a lot of skill and energy in order to navigate white spaces, right? Like you've become quite skilled at that. At the same time, like navigating those spaces, it does take its toll, right? And I'm, you know, I know that like you know how much you're pouring into your seed rematriation is part of like, you know, I guess healing from that. But would you talk about that just a little bit about, you know, just your own, I guess, coming into your own through seed rematriation after having, you know, to become a professional, or even just that in relation to that experience of navigating white spaces in order to like succeed, right, in that world?
Yeah, that's a huge question and something that I've been battling for, you know, my entire life, really. So, and I did grow up on the reservation here. There, we were bused out to a public school. So you get right away, there's not a whole lot of Indian kids in the school because our reservation is kind of divvied up like a pie where they shoved all the kids to the white school. So I had to learn pretty quick on how to navigate those spaces. And And I really thought the way to help my community was to be an attorney. And I went to law school, and I came straight home, and I was an attorney for my nation for 13 years. But I remember early on, it was funny. We were in a meeting and we were going around the room introducing ourselves, and somebody introduced themselves as a recovering attorney. And I thought, why would you do that to yourself? Go to law school and then not practice law? You're crazy. And now it's like, oh, I get it. I understand now. So when I went back to earn my PhD, it was again in our community, looking at our land use and how we're working or not working with our neighbors on how it's about sovereignty over our land and our space, and trying to do that in face of all of these things that are coming at us, mostly local governments trying to tell us what to do, how to do it, where to do it, get their permits. You're not a real tribe. You're just a landowner. So even on the reservation, we still get those same things that you do in the city, where colonizers think that it's really their way to hold that space. And in my work with the seeds, it really came right around the same time as that career change, when I was exhausted. I was done with it. I thought, maybe this isn't the way to be able to really help and give back to the community. And, you know, when we grew that corn that first year, it really just grabbed hold. It grabbed hold and it took over. So I'm just really glad that teacher, I think you both mentioned those seeds as our teachers, have really been the greatest education that I could possibly receive, and the one that's going to be the most meaningful to me and to my children and to our community, because that's really where our knowledge is. That's where our ceremonies are. That's where our history is. In those seeds is what lies everything that the colonizers tried to take away from us. And we are regaining that back. We're reclaiming it, and we're sharing it with those people who might not have ready access to it yet, or maybe they're not ready to learn it yet. But when they're ready, we'll be here to help with those seeds.
Yeah, thank you. Another thing that just really comes to mind when it comes to, you know, our relationship with our seed relatives is that I think, we just finished up a series of rematriation webinars, through the partnership with Seed Savers Exchange. And I noticed that there was always a lot of our audience members, right, in the webinars that were really eager to, come into possession, right, of our Indigenous seeds. And so there's, you know, it's a troublesome kind of line to navigate, as far as, you know, educating folks about the rematriation work that we do, at the same time, like cautioning people to not fall into that appropriating behavior, right? That's like so much a part of American culture. I mean, it's like, you know, look at Amazon, you know, how you can just access things with a few clicks of your mouse and your credit card and come into possession of things so easily without, you know, having to do that through teachings and relationships. So I'm just opening up to any three of you to kind of like give your thoughts and your feelings. You know, let's hear some of your heart work about this, because, you know, really we got to, there's just so much appropriation going on that it's something that needs to be spoken to. Thank you. And I can call on one of you. I'm Kirsten. Everybody's too polite to jump in. Kirsten, do you want to start?
Yeah, no problem. I've actually come into a lot of contact with this appropriative behavior through cooking. I see it less in the growing of food. Definitely it's there. But when it comes to cooking, I think the things that we've depended on since time immemorial have become exotified to these chefs who are mostly of a European background. And recently it was ramp season, so like wild leeks. And I went back to a patch to harvest, and I noticed you know, hundreds have been pulled by their root system, which ramps take at least 4 years from seed to even propagate and become thriving plants. And so sometimes it's a fine line between realizing that seeds have autonomy and it's not up to me to tell people how to interact with plants. But I definitely do want to do that a lot. I would love to call everybody out on harvesting ramps from their roots and, you know, over harvesting plenty of other plants. But ultimately, I think it is my role to educate people and have relationships with people that maybe, and yeah, like it is unfair, but to educate people on the importance of preserving Indigenous food for the Indigenous population. I saw something, I'll try to credit it if I can, but there's something going around saying, like, what is your relationship to this plant? And if you don't have a history, if you don't have a relationship with it, and it's being threatened, then what right do you have? Like, rights by nature, right? Like, an agreement with nature. Like, what do you have agreement-wise to harvest or interact with this plant? And I think that's a very important question. And I ask it all the time, like, am I harvesting too much? Like, what do I have? What do I have in terms of relationship with this plant to take care of it? And like, what am I returning to the plant? Am I just taking or am I giving something in return? So I think that's an important thing for everybody to ask themselves.
Yeah, thank you for that perspective. I think something occurred to me just to, you know, and it's in connection to all of this, but like Rosebud, I know that you had to move recently, relocate. All of us, you know, all four of us here are, you know, have had, you know, just a history of removal, right? We've had 500 years of this, you know, from our ancestral lands. Like, for example, Becky and I, we live on our current tribal homelands, but that's not our historic tribal homelands. And I think, like, probably a lot of folks in the audience don't really understand how so much of that was, you know, even like the relocation of Native folks to the urban areas was very much a United States policy, right? Especially post-World War, you know, right around that era in the 50s. And so Rosebud, if you would speak to, you know, how you've been able to stay resilient, right, and strong, and continue the work of building community while experiencing, you know, displacement.
Yeah. I always think about this a lot because, you know, this is the land I've only ever known. And I think that is true for a lot of urban natives, urban Indigenous people. I was born and raised right in Detroit, and there's so much I could say. My mind's going in a million different ways, but you know, having this connection to land here in the city, there's always talk about land ownership. And I often find myself I'm always the only one in the room, like internally rolling my eyes, like, man, none of you own this land. The land owns us, right? We're here to care for this land. It's a reminder that I've had to say multiple times in multiple spaces. And as a farmer here in the city, it's hard. It's hard out here. When we were growing in a public space and we were just trying to care for these seeds. We were just trying to, you know, give them a place to grow and care for them. But we ended up being like, you know, again, like always with our head on the swivel and in like major protection mode. And also like, you know, in the educator mode all the time. And it's, you know, it's hard, but what keeps me going are spaces like this and colleagues like Becky and Kirsten and folks all, you know, all around doing this work. That's this type of stuff is what revives me and keeps me going. Knowing that there are other people just like me in their parts of the world fighting just like me. And that gives me hope for sure. I hope that answers the question.
Well, it's not so much a question as it is, you know, just inviting you to, you know, provide your reflections. And even in, and I see, you know, I see you like, and I see you struggling to kind of hold things back, you know, in really being honest about your experience, because once again, that's something that we've been taught to navigate the white world, right? To really very carefully change, you know, very carefully choose our language so as to not make others uncomfortable, which is right. others from the group that has, you know, that are the occupiers, right? Mm-hmm. The invaders. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, sometimes quite literally have guns pointed at us, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah. something as simple as going to the sugar bush, which is you're going there in ceremony to tap maple trees to collect sap to cook down into maple syrup. What mm-hmm. can be like coming out of, you know, a cold winter and coming into like relationship with these trees, which was such gratitude, right? This was like a lifeline for us coming out of the cold winters. And being able to refine these sugars, I mean, it's just amazing from our mm-hmm. tree relatives, and to have it, you know, be surrounded by police. I mean, that's, so it's, yeah, it's this work that we do, it isn't the same as ordering seed from a catalog, right? Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, there's a reason why we have to keep our heads on the swivel, because, you know, this is an active form of resistance and an active form of decolonization.
Yeah, I also want to add, you know, sorry to cut you off, but I'd also want to add that we are also women doing this work in a heavily male-driven, you know, agriculture field. I'm often one of the only women doing this work. That's an Indigenous woman who is strong and can stand up for herself. You have to be careful. And there's also like the other, you know, the other layer is sometimes you're working in these institutions that, yeah, we want food sovereignty. Yeah, we want this great stuff. Like here's the tools to do it. Here are the resources to do it, but do it my way. And you still have to, you know, justify every single thing that you do. Sometimes we're working in spaces that we're trying to decolonize that don't want to be decolonized. And I think that is something that you really have to remember. You're going to get me fired up, Shelley. I'm trying to hold it back.
No, that's what I'm here for. when I first heard Vandana Shiva
speak. I think that was in 2015. She came to Iowa. I broke down like in uncontrollable sobbing because it was one of the first times where, I heard someone really articulate that relationship between the harm destruction done to our seeds in relation to the harm and destruction, the violence upon women's bodies. It's United States policy. Well, even before the United States was the United States, actually, I think it may have been for us Great Lakes tribes. I think it may have been the French, who, by the way, Meskwaki are the reason that French isn't spoken in this part of the United States. 40 years of resistance against the French pretty much caused the sale of the Louisiana Purchase. We bankrupt them. Like, you can't make 40 years of war on foreign soil without it costing a lot of money. Yay. Anyway, I just had to plug that in there. But they really quickly realized that, in order to dispossess Indigenous folks of their land, they had to attack the women. Right. So, I mean, it began a campaign basically of misogynistic propaganda and continues today with, the missing and murdered Indigenous women, which is, it's not even, I think, fortunately, with Deb Haaland, Secretary of the Interior, now that there's actually efforts for that to be tracked. But prior to that, there was no tracking of the numbers. I did want to speak to land access really quick. And there was in the chat, there's a question about, education and outreach. But real quick, I want to bring up land access because it's huge. I think that there's a lot of assumptions that since tribes have reservations, that there must be land access. But even upon reservations, there's very little to almost no land access. So I want to speak to that, especially in the upper Midwest. We have a lot of land that now is potentially going to be in transition, a lot of farmland that's going into transition in the next 10 years, meaning that, the previous, families that have inherited this farmland are coming, are aging out of farming, and they're going to be selling their farms. Many of those farmland owners are women, actually. So let's talk a little bit about land access.
I can mention, because you talked about on reservations, how people think we have a lot of land, and Oneida is in a very fortunate position. We have thousands of acres of land that the Oneida tribe owns, and it's agricultural land. But the problem is that we've acquired it without really having a plan for what to do with it. So either we have a tribal department that continues to cash crop, corn and soybeans, and doesn't really grow a lot of food for actual people to consume. And our processes on how to lease that land aren't very beneficial or favorable to small scale farmers or Indigenous co-ops or anything like that. It's really difficult to try to get land from the tribe because they say, watch the advertisements. And it's like, well, I'm not going to bid on 100-acre piece of land that I don't want 100 acres. So I'm extra critical because I'm actually the chairwoman of the Oneida Land Commission. And we have been trying for over the past 6 years on my tenure on the Land Commission to try to change that. And change is so difficult. And we're just trying to say, let's make a process where a tribal member can come to us and say, hey, I want 2 acres of land to start a berry co-op. It should not be that difficult for the tribe to turn around and say, hey, all right, let's try to look for some land. But for some reason, it's really difficult to get that. So even in cases where tribes do have land, land access is still a problem.
Well, the same goes for Detroit, as you can probably imagine. Detroit has not has a long history of not being managed properly. Trying to access and purchase land is a hot mess. And you know, if you ever Google Detroit and its agricultural scene here, it gives the impression that there's farmers everywhere. There's, you know, people, you know, farming and growing things. And while that's true, there's also a piece of that story that's missing. And that piece is the fact that there's been neighbors, you know, residents of Detroit that have vacant lots on either side of them or live in a neighborhood that it's mostly vacant lots. They've been caring for that land for quite some time, but they don't own it and they can't own it and they can't get Detroit to sell it to them. And now, you know, government has changed, hands have changed, and things are trying to get more organized and do things, you know, in a procedural type of way. But then these actual people, these landowners or these caretakers of this land are losing out now to gentrification and these, you know, young folks coming in that have the money, that have the know-how, that have the access to, you know, land to do a quick land grab. And then, you know, there's the 6-year-old family that's been caring for these vacant lots for their entire life, and it's gone. That happens all the time. Wanted to throw that out there. That's also a huge thing that happens.
Yeah, I got the 2-minute warning 1 minute ago. So we're going to be running out of time here and in probably 45 seconds. I want to just, I wish we had longer time, right, to share our perspective and experience with everybody. I just want to thank the three of you for your time and for your knowledge, and especially for the work that you continue to do. I want the audience to understand this is like, it's on one time, at one on one hand, this work connects us to our ancestors and it gives us strength. On the other hand, this is very difficult work to do, right? This is like an active resistance of colonization, and especially in women, in the feminine body, in a dominant system that seeks to harm us, cause us harm. So I want to encourage folks to continue to explore seed rematriation work. I don't know if any of the slow food hosts want to chime in before we say goodbye.
I can chime in and say thank you so much. My name is Mara Welton. I'm the director of programs and have pulled together this panel for today because this work is ongoing. It's historic. And it's our future, I think, and certainly the future of these communities. And I just really am so grateful to you for sharing your experience and your knowledge. Deep gratitude to all of you for opening the eyes of our network to some of this really hard work that's being done in your communities. And anything that our network can do to help uplift your efforts, please, I'm only a phone call away. We'll do what we can. And we'll certainly invite you back for a longer conversation in the future. Thank you. Just thank you so much. We are having another session with our authors coming up next. Please stick around.
This show is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.